Greetings to the crew of the Gaia Navigation Experiment. This is your nav back in the mailroom. Today is Sunday, the 29th of July, 2012. What I'd like to do today is come forward, picking up some mail that started to come in at the beginning of March this year. So I'm going to clear the month of March in this current mailroom session, which is number 6 in the series. To kick off, I've got an email here from Stacy, S-T-A-C-I, with a link to a remarkable discovery, which was the world's oldest fossilized forest. The Gilboa Fossil Forest, which has been discovered now in upstate New York in the Catskill Mountains. And if you go by the currently accepted geological scale, it dates back about 385 million years. Now that's a little more than about halfway back to the end of the Cambrian explosion. And it was at the end of the Cambrian explosion that the human anatomical form, as it appears today, initially emerged. And it emerged in an arboreal kind of creature, the arboreal nymphs of Gaia. And this arboreal human / arboreal life form emerged after the Cambrian explosion, and this fossil forest relates back to a little more than halfway on that time scale, if you accept that time scale as anything valid. The time scale for the Cambrian explosion, correct me if I'm wrong, is something like 535 to 585 million years ago. What's remarkable about this discovery is some of the images that are contained on this clip, which can be found in the in Nature magazine. And just look for world's oldest fossilized forest revealed. They show a picture of a fossilized plant standing upright. It's a Gilboa fossil tree. And this plant has a trunk somewhat articulated like the trunk of a palm tree, and then it fans out into the limbs and to the branches. And what you see when you look at this fossil of the Gilboa tree is a perfect replica of a human neuron, of the human neuronal circuit in the brain. Remember a while back I was talking about the three concepts of Gaian physics. These are not merely concepts in the abstract sense. They are more concepts in Goethean sense. That is to say, these concepts are actually conceptual lenses for looking at nature. So I described reticulation and articulation as two of these lenses. And when you look at the fossil of the Gilboa tree, or you look at a representation of the human synapses, you see exactly the same thing. You see the reticulated stem from which is sprouting the articulated branches. So it's remarkable look into the past, but it's also a remarkable look into the human brain as it functions today. I would say, speaking in the vein of Gaian physics, Gaian biophysics and the prehistory of this planet, that the human animal, as it emerged from its plasmic state, and there's a word here, spawn, S-P-A-W-N. You know, like the spawn of fish or the spawn of frogs, which is that polywog jelly that the little tadpoles nest in. If you've ever seen that in a pond in the springtime, it's fascinating to observe. I remember as a child in Friendship, Maine, I always used to walk home along the path behind the school, and there was a pond beside the path. In the winter, that pond froze over, and we went skating. In the spring, it thawed, and you could always find the spawn of frogs there with this transparent gel with the tadpoles in it. That is more or less the form in which the plasma of the anthropos was deposited on this planet. And in the beginning, it did not first have the anatomical definition. Our species did not have the anatomical definition it now has. And as our species began to assume its anatomical definition, which is a fascinating scenario to say the least, the evolving organism borrowed certain aspects of its anatomy from the natural world in which it was deeply immersed. We did not evolve in a Darwinian fashion in some kind of sequence following sea creatures who become amphibian, then these amphibian creatures become some kind of land-dwelling marmot, then they become the tree-dwelling Lemurians, then they become chimpanzees. No, we did not evolve in that serial sequence. That's an erroneous fiction. We evolved more according to the principle of endosymbiosis propounded by Lynn Margulis. Endosymbiosis is a process by which different organisms live inside other organisms. So in the beginning, the spawn of the anthropos deposited upon this planet, seeded upon this planet, to use the conventional term, was nested in the life matrix of the planet, and particularly in the plant matrix and in the sea. And there are plants in the sea, obviously. And these plants in the sea emerged upon the land and they became tubular plants. And from those tubular plants, which first assumed clear definition following the Cambrian explosion, the early anatomical form of a human being emerged. And they were strictly of a feminine gender. And as the human form developed, it incorporated into itself, it borrowed for its organization certain aspects of the natural world. So I would say, you know, not to go for hours and hours into this scenario, I'm just giving you a glimpse here. I would say that the Gilboa tree fossil shows that the development of the human organism, in its development, the human organism borrowed that form of nature, the reticulated and articulated tree branch, tree trunk, borrowed it and incorporated it into the cerebral structures of the brain. And the brain itself is a kind of spawn. You know, the brain as it exists right now in the human skull is not like the brain that you see, which resembles cauliflower. That is the brain that has been surgically removed from a deceased person. The brain in a living person is nothing more than a mesh of wet Kleenex. It has the consistency of wet Kleenex with electrical charges flashing through it. So it is kind of a spawn. It's like the initial spawn of the anthropos that was deposited on the shores of the earth and took part of its life from the sea and part of its structure from the land. So it's wonderful to look back through this window in time. This is a most relevant discovery. Here's a brief message from Malovia in BC, Canada. She expresses her interest in my notion my suggestion that anatomical birth and reproduction by mitosis was not in the original plan for our species. As you know, that's a real deal breaker. Some people probably write me off on that point. But here's one person who finds that it makes sense. Another confirmation, if you will, along those lines, this comes from Ilse. She writes, I am not at all put off by the protest against procreation. In fact, it makes sense to me, but then I might already have been in tune with this as I am a healthy, intelligent, reasonably attractive 56-year-old non-homosexual woman who resisted the social pressure of the idea that making flesh and blood children in the uterus was a natural and normal course of life. She continues, I am hungry for further clarification of the Gnostic view of procreation, the mistake of utero-vaginal birth, and how humanity was otherwise meant to perpetuate itself as it journeys with Sophia. Until then, I can only imagine. Well, thank you, Ilse. She also says, I resonate with your remark that tantricas do not turn away from difficult situations, but rather use them as a means of conjuring real power. I shall now look upon my several present personal challenges in a fresh new way. Excellent. Next, a message from Bobby, B-O-B-B-I-E, and a link to the Extinction Protocol. Well, that's a website, I believe, 2012 and beyond. And here you go. Irish residents' lives wrecked by mysterious humming noise. There's the article is dated March 3rd, 2012. Despairing residents in a remote Kerry parish have told how their lives have been made a living hell by a mystery humming noise. Wow, this beautiful picture of the coastline of County Kerry. In fact, I think I know that beach. I've wandered along and explored those beaches. It's the westernmost part of the British Isles extending into the Atlantic. And so I know this region very well, and the remarkable detail I pick up from this article comes from a resident who says, quote, the first time we heard it was in April 2011, and it has been there 24/7 since, end quote. Well, April 2011, that's just 1 month after the inception of correction. What would this noise be? Some kind of hum? Is it a genuine sound coming from the earth? Or is it due to some kind of sinister military experiment? I don't know. It's very difficult to sort these things out, as you know. But I tend to think that a good part of these noises, these mysterious sounds, are genuine. They are natural. And they are actually coming from the planet due to the extraordinary physical conditions the mothership undergoes as she takes on self-navigation and self-propulsion. And speaking of the mothership, sailing into the high seas of the galactic slipstream, here's a dream recounted by Miguel. Quote, I found myself on the outside of a glass door at the bow of the mothership, and the other person on the inside. I was shouting for the other person to come outside where I was so to escape the flood, but they couldn't budge, nor could I move towards them to pull them away. I was rooted to the spot. I watched in terror as the other person was swept away, arms outstretched towards me in terror on their face. I woke screaming in my helplessness and horror, end quote. And then he said that after that he heard the talk I gave where I described the waves breaking over the bow of the mother ship and the jetsam and flotsam to come. And to him that explained to a large extent the nature of this dream. He was dreaming about what I was actually talking about at the moment that I was talking about it, probably. Jumping back to the dicey subject of procreation, here's a message from Cisco. I love this one. Referring to briefing number two, NAV briefing number two. Quote, regarding this briefing, anyone who cannot embrace this just isn't paying attention. I came to this conclusion years ago before I ever encountered the Gnostic teachings. What could possibly be logical and right about a parasitic method of reproduction? I suspect most of the objections come from women for the obvious reasons. By the way, I am a woman and have reproduced. I don't see anything miraculous or divine about it. End quote. Well, thank you for your brutal honesty on that point, Cisco. Here's an interesting message from Sarah, spelled with an H. She responds to some of my comments on heroism in men and women, and she confronts me, saying, to my mind, what I am doing, what you are doing, John, is a reweaving of the old paradigm story, Men come to the rescue and women put their trust in faith in someone else. And then she quotes this line, which I guess is from yours truly. Quote, women must come to recognize the heroic in men so that men can claim their honor and act in behalf of humanity. End quote. Sarah doesn't exactly agree with this. She says, I wish to recognize the heroic in women first. I wish for women to claim their full power and knowing first. I am not giving the male species so deeply rooted in this patriarchal program my power. My trust lies in the new female warrior. Well, so does mine, Sarah. And I think you mistook me or misread me if you think that I am reworking the old paradigm. I am not reworking the old paradigm. I'm beating the old paradigm down into the ground with all the insight and might that I can muster. She says, gives me this advice. Trust the dream enough to step away. Yes, step away and thereby allow women to lead with their heart, mind. Can you do that, John? Step away. Seems that you are too comfortable, that you too are comfortable with the role of men saving the day. End quote. Well, I'm not at all. It's not at all my position. And can I step away? I told you, I stepped away. I stepped away in March when I read the sky looking at the Jupiter-Venus conjunction before the face of the ram. And I understood that it is not women who lead and it is not men who lead. It is the terma of Gaia Awakening that leads. It is the story that leads. And men and women act heroically depending on how they engage that story. And certainly, I think women are first to come to the forefront in the path of Gaian eco-sorcery. They are, to my mind, the ones who show up first. But it has to be a gender-balanced situation. And so I'm certainly not proposing that men are the ones who save the day and rescue women according to the old phony paradigm of patriarchy. Finally, Sarah, you've read me wrong in that way, Sarah, if you get that message, or else I've stated myself wrong, which is not beyond the realm of possibility. She concludes, one of the oldest mythologies that I am sure you are most familiar with is that of the Dogon. The Numo were feminine in essence, androgynous beings, yet possessing both sexes. If you have the inclination, check out the research of Sharon Dorey, end quote. Well, yeah, I know all about the Dogon. I've had extensive and intimate conversations with Robert Temple, who wrote The Serious Mystery. And I would like you, Sarah, or anyone else who is fascinated by the Numo mythology of the Dogon, to explain why the Dogon is such a rigid patriarchal and anti-feminist culture. I don't cite the Dogon. That's one reason why I shy off from Dogon mythology, even though it is a genuine indigenous mythology with some very deep clues to our place in the cosmos. But I shy away from it because the Dogon society and Dogon culture It's intensely patriarchal. I don't like to filter. Next comes a mail entitled White Tsunami. Now, there's an intriguing title. This is from Gladys in Las Palmas in the Canary Islands. She recounts a dream. Last night I had a dream and you were in it. It was dark. We were walking down a street from direction right to left on the dreaming screen. We were in the middle of the road when we heard something and stopped in our tracks, our backs to the dreaming screen. Suddenly an enormous, gigantic ocean wall of milk paint kefir, creamy white stuff, just loomed toward us, taking over every inch of space between cars and buildings. It had the force and strength of a live creature as it swept and covered everywhere. People were running, but we just stood there and let it wrap us and lift us until we were floating, heavily pushing us backwards and forwards, up and down. While that was happening, you encircled me from the waist with your left arm and held me fast and firm, but not tight, to prevent me from floating away. While we looked on in amazement, we began to see stuff floating around us. We remained in the same place, although moving within the motion of the wave. The sensation it gave me was of immensity, awesomeness, and reverence while we floated there for what seemed to be an endless time, waiting for it to end. For a second, I experienced a pang of fear, and we felt this ocean apologize to us for having caught us in the middle of the turmoil. Then I felt an excruciating pain right in the center of my chest, and I awoke. The pain is still there. It lasted strong for a while. I still have it now as I type, but only a lingering remnant. End quote. Fantastic dream, obviously, of the tsunami, of the organic light. Also, I'd point out that a blow in the center of the chest is not like a blow on the left, which is a Kali initiation blow. The blow in the center of the chest is connected with the development of the 18-petaled lotus at the center of the chest, right there where the thymus, just a little below the location of the thymus. So this is a remarkable dream with a physical effect following it. Have you note that? That's to say, it was a real dream, it was a real vision of something that is continually happening on the planet. And I would characterize this most certainly in the genre of initiatory dreams. Next up, a brief message from George. This is March 6th. Hi, John. My partner and I began practicing the carnal embrace last week. The first time brought a swell of emotion really sweeping over us, clearing flotsam that needed to be washed overboard. The second time healed all the scars left over. This experiment keeps getting better and better. Your narratives are awe-inspiring. Thank you for your intense dedication. Totally resonates from my heart to yours. Next comes a message from Julie F. She's a faithful correspondent. Her emails are always throbbing with wonderful energy, the energy of discovery, of excitement, the wonder of participating in the Gaia navigation experiment, the thrill of discovery that comes with planetary tantra. I had two long emails in succession from her, which I may have responded to in writing back in March. I can't recall. But in this one she says, I have noticed in my own self and in a few other people that when they have experienced a great shock of Kali Ma, that for a while there is an imbalance of the coloring of the eyes. It's not really a pupil dilation, although that is happening slightly too, but the iris color differentiates due to perhaps contractions in the iris and changing the color. That coloring difference, at least for me, has dissipated, but will show up in intensely emotional situations. Julie is one of those crew members who experiences the teachings and the practice in a visceral way, in intense bodily sensations. And in almost every email, she recounts her remarkable sensations. And this one, she continues, Judier talks, and after reviewing some information on the hippocampus, that seems to be the organ that is affected to bring on the eye change. Another thing I've noticed is that in males, it seems to be the right eye that is changed, and in females, the left eye. But that may not follow suit because I don't know that many people yet who have experienced Kalima. End quote. Anyway, the hippocampus clue is really intriguing. It was also, I also had occasion to be introduced to this clue by Stephanie when she wrote me from Nepal. Stephanie, who is an avid tantrika and crew member, is a deep student of Vedic knowledge and following the rather scientific metaphysics of Maharishi, I might say. And she cited a passage in a massive book written by some of Maharishi's followers, Maharishi Mahesh, who was, of course, the well-known guru of the Beatles, a book compiled by some of his followers containing extremely detailed neuroanatomical information reflected in Sanskrit and Vedic teachings. And the hippocampus is a part of the human anatomy that figures in these ancient Vedic teachings. Stephanie clued me to the fact that the hippocampus is actually connected with the figure of Kalki on a white horse, because it is a horse. Hippo means horse, not hippopotamus. It's a root indicating the horse, the equine species. The hippocampus is, of course, a seahorse, I believe. So this is a remarkable clue to human anatomy, which in some respects may be related to the recalibration of the anthropos. And what Julie is detecting may indicate a way to recognize people who are sensitive to this recalibration. I think it's really amazing that she could be so observant as to notice these changes in pupil dilation. That's very, very high practice of the first attention. Next is an interesting message from Daniel in Berlin. Daniel's an artist and composer. He writes, I have conducted my own plant-induced ceremonies with strong bonds to the Sethians, even before I got to know your existence. I've had no encounter with the light, and I feel I may not be worthy of that gift, but I've had my own epiphanies. What I did is to create 10 pieces of music directly centered around the Sophianic mythopoeia and Gnostic lore, as was shown to me in my visions given by the Holy Mushroom. In short, I was told to create my own Merkaba. At that time, I had no clue about Kabbalah, in music that would then aid me in rituals. Music made to ascend and also to please the intelligence behind the mushroom. End quote. So then he goes on to send me a sample of this music. First of all, I want to say encountering the organic light has nothing to do with being worthy or unworthy. This has to do with having the sufficient attention directed in the correct manner. This is a good occasion. This email is a good occasion for me to respond to or to make a disclosure about my own inadequacy, I should say. Occasionally, over the years, I've had mail to metahistory.org and now to the Navigator from visual artists and musicians who are proposing, either they are presenting something they've done that has affinities with the Sophianic and Gnostic material, or else they're proposing they could even contribute to the Sophianic practice with their art and with their music. I have to say that I am completely open to this offer, but I am totally unable to judge this what is being offered. I put it in that way. You know, it's a peculiar thing about me. I'm pretty sophisticated in some ways when it comes to art and literature. I spent a good part of my life from a very early age immersed in the painting and the literature and the poetry and the high intellectual culture of Western civilization. But I have a drop-off point. I can appreciate and evaluate art and music and poetry and painting and sculpture up until about 1955. From that point on, I can't evaluate anything. I have been really out of the loop. So if you want to have a discussion with me about Baudelaire, or you want to talk about modernism, you can talk to me about modernism for 3 months without a break. But I can't talk about much that's happened since the 50s or 60s, except in rare cases of particular individuals, such as, say, for instance, the poetry of Diane de Prima. Her poetry, particularly Loba, which has some bearing, I might say, on the lucid dreaming of Sophia, extended into the late 70s, I think, maybe even up as far as the 90s, but that's a rare case. I just don't have any feeling for what the younger generation is doing today in music, painting, and art. I honestly don't. I can't judge it. My assessment is not trustworthy. So even though I am certainly open to artistic input that would be compatible with a Sophianic vision and the practice of planetary tantra, when it's presented to me, I just have no comment because I'm just not qualified to say one way or the other how it fits or how it could be integrated into this process. That's for others to determine, and it really falls outside of my realm. So I just wanted you to know that I don't disregard any of you who've written to me in that respect. Recently also I've had someone, Chinese, American Chinese individual, I believe, filmmaker, also approached me and with some samples of his work and so forth. I just really don't know what to say. I'm just really out of it when it comes to that side of our culture. Next comes a beautiful image of a great gray owl with its wings outspread, sent in by Maggie Lee of Santa Fe, Santa Monica. She points out that in the March issue of Resurgence magazine is about animal ethics. Well, I didn't catch that. But as you know, on the talks with Grok, I did spend quite a lot of time talking about ethology. Ethology as a framework, an inceptive framework for Gaian ethics. So it might be worth looking up that issue of Resurgence magazine to see what they have to say there. Here's a brief message from Crazy Bitch Carol in Tucson, reporting on her watch over the Pleiades, rising over the Catalinas during the moment of the Venus-Jupiter conjunction in March. She also recounts a dream that she had of certain cosmic events. I think it's to be anticipated that your involvement in this experiment will change your dreams. Most of you, I would say, would attest to that. And it's typical of those in the GNE and planetary tantra to have dreams of seeing events in the sky or dreams actually of constellations. This is an indication that the pleromic dreaming of the aeons is breaking through into your subconscious. Further proof of this subliminal breakthrough experience comes from Shelley, who's writing from the area of Spokane, Washington. And she describes how she had a dream, which I won't recount in due to its complex detail. And then she went to a Qigong class. And as she was returning from that class, she found herself on a section of highway which had figured in the dream. And just at that moment, a car came down the hill just as it had done in the dream, and she remembered that she had dreamed it the night before. So this is an example not only of the pleromic power of divine dreaming bursting through into the subconscious, but the power of the subconscious bursting through into physical manifestation, as it were. The power of the subconscious, and this is a theme, of course, of many films these days. Some of them are very badly done. They're too heavy on special effects, but it is a prominent theme, how the power of the subconscious manifests itself by shaping, directing, or manipulating physical reality. So this can happen spontaneously. And in fact, it would be perfectly natural if it does happen spontaneously. It's perfectly natural. Not something, there's a point where the paranormal becomes natural, and that's where you're going in this experiment. Coming down to the last week in March here, I'd say I've got about 15 emails yet to go to clear the month of March. Here's a message from Aaron dated March 23rd. I just wanted to tell you this. Yesterday I met this 36-year-old young man from Iran. Assad is his name. He's in the USA for 2 weeks now, and we got to talking, and he said many interesting things, one of which is that the number one book people his age and young people in the university is absolutely craving is all of Carlos Castaneda books. Blew my mind. I gave him the metahistory.org website, the GNE webpage, and also told him to write you with any questions. He was very excited to get this information. Talking to a young Iranian about shamanic connection to Mama Gaia was amazing. Yeah, well, thank you for that hit, Aaron. It is pretty amazing, because we never know what's out there. Don't have so far any crew members in Iran or Iraq, as far as I know. The odd thing is, I don't have any crew members in Germany. You know, Not in His Image is currently published in French, thanks to Dominique Guillet of Cocopelli. The French title is La Passion de la Terre. It's being translated into Spanish chapter by chapter, though I don't have a publisher yet. The Italian translation is coming out the end of the year. Supposedly it's being translated into Romanian. There are crew members scattered pretty much all over Europe, but there is not one single crew member from Germany. And I can't ever recall getting an email from Germany or from a German. I've got a few emails from Germany, but not from native German people. So I find that to be a most interesting absence. Germany is really most interesting by its absence. And you know, in Germany, speaking of Carlos Castaneda, there was a huge cult following of Castaneda in Germany. There was a time years ago, I can remember, when you could go into a pretty much mainstream bookstore in Frankfurt or Berlin or Munich or any large German city, and they would have a wall of Castaneda books in the New Age section. A wall of all his books translated. I mean, Castaneda was huge in Germany. I find it remarkable that no one in Germany has picked up on Planetary Tantra yet. I also find it remarkable that I have no interest from a German publisher. I mean, I can't think of a country that, you know, of course the heavy-duty Catholic countries like Spain, Italy, and France are going to be rocked and shocked by Not in His Image. But I would think that the Germans would have picked up on it by now. It's such a high intellectual culture, and they're great scholars of the ancient sources and the mysteries. So I'm really baffled by that. If anybody has a clue on that, let me know. If anybody has any German connections, please send them my way. Here's an email from Sibyl, dated March 24th. You might remember that Sibyl, a.k.a. Balsam, is a correspondent on the crew who is intensely interested in the subject of chemtrails and Morgellons, and also who has had some experience with in psychic warfare and the intrusion of archontic entities and bizarre experiences of that kind. I've been in dialogue with Sibyl on this a few times and hope to pick that dialogue up again on Skype one of these days. She mentions at the close of her email, "I have also tried the plaster method for seeing the organic light and was successful, though not to the same dramatic extent as Kundry. It was a very profound experience. Nonetheless, I plan to continue practicing." Here's a brief report from Susanna in New York City. Quote, "I did make the vow yesterday in Central Park, up on the northwest side in an area called the North Woods. It is left wild with many fallen trees, waterfalls, huge rock piles, and is an acclaimed bird sanctuary. The day of the new moon and the glorious sun with two friends made it all wonderful. I feel aligned, happy, and ready to go on, an increasingly energized crew member." Well, that's fantastic, Susanna. It never occurred to me that anyone could do the Gayan Tantric vow in Central Park. I mean, that is outstanding. Next is a brief mail from crew member Dan, who signs in sometimes as Wisdom Stone. He writes, "I now see the sunset crescent out my window this gorgeous spring evening. Venus and Jupiter are drifting away. I think I will now step outside with my glass of wine and observe what I can in this light-polluted small city." Well, you know, a number of you report to me the difficulties in observing the sky, and that can be frustrating since the navigational experience does involve sailing by the stars. But keep looking, who knows, and get out into the country on any chance you can, on any occasion you can, where you may find more favorable viewing conditions. In any case, if you're not able to see what's happening in the sky, take a moment or two to visualize it, and that way use your imagination to replace what is not accessible to observation. Next up is a message from Mountain Man. Contains many reflections on the parallels between Toltec shamanism and planetary tantra. These parallels are often pointed out to me, and I'm aware that in certain respects the Toltec shamanic tradition is a precursor of interactive magic with Gaia. Mountain Man writes he shares some features of his own personal spiritual view. For instance, he says, "The universe has one and only one agenda, freedom and no judgment. The creation of all and anything as all and everything already exists in the moment. The universal energy has no attitude and is but change itself, and there is nothing in our energies that does not change. We are change itself, and we are to be that which changes." Amen, brother. Or I should say, a woman. Very, very well said. I'd like to sit down some time around a campfire in the hills of Andalusia and have a long talk about the Toltecs and talk would be most rewarding for all concerned, I'm sure. Next is a highly detailed email from Rohan, who is down under in New Zealand area. I guess it would be the Waitakere Range of rainforest and bush, and the west coast of Auckland. There's a little crew of Gaian tantricas down there, including Michael, who knows me from years back in L.A. and Santa Fe. Michael in New Zealand is one of the few people on the team who's actually known the Turton in previous eons. This team down under are doing some wonderful things, courtings, Gaian Tantric vow. Rohan is writing about the excitement of the second Swandeva shift that happened this spring. It was stunning out there Sunday for about an hour's view with Venus and Jupiter still close to the sunset crescent. So I was inspired to send you some pics of it from down under. Some beautiful days here in autumn. Since our VV vow in Matangi Moon, I felt more in tune with nature and noticed fantail birds coming very close to me, often when I'm jogging in the forest. Dave and I also started Wing Chun Kung Fu classes soon, after which historically was named after its grandmaster, a totally undefeatable Chinese woman who could take on multiple expert male attackers. This style mixes about 7 animal styles. I thought it was interesting you said that Matangi was like an internal martial arts instructor. But also with the Year of the Dragon, I've been feeling the urge to be very active and achieve a lot. More action and less talk. So what Rohan is alluding to is the remarkable connection between Matangi, who is the member of the Shakti cluster that leads the planetary vision quest for every single human animal, between Matangi and the animal styles known in Kung Fu and Tai Chi and the Asian martial arts. It's a remarkable thing that these martial arts, including Bagua, involve various animal styles. What are the animal styles of the Asian martial arts? They are ritualistic actions that were learned from observing animals. And at the same time, they are more than that. They're more than just the result of a naturalistic type imitation of animals by human animals. They are also ways that human animals discovered to allow the animal powers of the earth itself stream through the body as an energizing, healing force and also as a protective force. You know, I'm totally convinced that the martial arts component of planetary tantra is already becoming evident to many of you. Some members of the crew and some of you who have engaged in planetary tantra are already familiar with martial arts and have been doing them for years. It's a natural marriage between the martial arts and planetary tantra. And the figure of Matangi would be the outstanding guide to these practices insofar as they take on new forms and expressions in the Gaian perspective. Here's a message from Pedro, who signs in as North Vortex. I think Pedro is in, I don't know, Argentina. Subject is, I am going to take the Kali vow. The message says, Dear John, just this. 1. I understand that the only way to stop the interspecies predators is with a lethal strike. 2. I am going to take the Kali vow. 3. I am a beautiful animal in the divine Sophianic experiment, and I am very dangerous to the perpetrators. Regards, Pedro. Well, that's short and sweet. That subject, of course, touches on Kali Tantra, which takes us in a slightly different direction, or it takes us to a threshold opening to another realm of practice. Nevertheless, I would say that 1 in 10, maybe 2 in 10 of you who write me, in the context of the GNE, express your desire to be involved in the Kalika practices. Correction, a second email from Pedro indicates that he is in Calgary, Canada. Okay, that goes into the location file. So let's see. Wrapping up this session in the mailroom, I want to drop back and pick up 3 emails from February, actually. One of them is from Fletch in Santa Fe. He sends a snippet of a quotation from some Hindu text written about 1,000 years ago. This text is called Divya Mahakala Jnana, meaning divine knowledge of time. And the excerpt says that Kalki would arrive when the moon, sun, Venus, and Jupiter have entered the same sign. Such occurrences are not rare, and the next is expected in the year 2012 or afterwards. This is taken from a Wikipedia article called The Marriage of Kalki. Well, that's pretty relevant. In the course of this experiment recently, we've had occasion to observe the moon, Venus, and Jupiter in the same sign, both in the evening sky, in the spring, and in the morning sky, beginning in the first week in July. Of course, you cannot observe those planets and the moon when the sun is positioned in the same area. So the total configuration involving the sun would be non-observable, which is an interesting point that I'm sure was known to the Vedic scholars or sages who made this prediction. Hence, we've had the occasion to observe a couple of variations of this most significant cosmic configuration. Now, if you want to go back and look for the moment that most closely conforms to the specifics of this passage, you would go to June. I'm looking now at the Astrodienst ephemeris online because I don't have my leather-bound ephemerides here with me. If you go and you look at, say, June 18th, 2012, you'll see that on that day, the sun was in the bull, the sun, right at the horn tip, the tip of the lower horn, which is also the position of the Crab Nebula, 27 degrees of Gemini, which is exactly the opposite of the sight line toward the galactic center. So there's an axis toward the galactic center, 27 Sagittarius, away from the galactic center in the opposite direction, 27 Gemini. So let's place the sun on that axis on June 18th. The moon then would have entered the bull and would have conjuncted Venus in 10 degrees of Gemini, which is very close to Aldebaran. Jupiter at that time stood in 2 degrees of Gemini, close to the Pleiades in the bull. So there is the exact day in 2012 that fits the description in this passage. Most significantly, of course, that was just about 10 days or so after Pleromic Relay came into play. So I think it's rather remarkable. You know, I don't follow Vedic or Hindu astronomy very much, or at all, actually. You might say I have some layers of it recorded in my subconscious and possibly even in my phylogenetic and diachronic memory, going back to the times of Asura Maya at the court of Lord Krishna around 3100 BCE, when astrology was invented, when and where it was invented. And it was invented, by the way, as a parlor game. So I have some kind of Vedic and Hindu NLP, certainly. But it's rather amazing that I did not refer to any Vedic or Hindu text of astronomical bearing. And yet, it turns out that the moment of pleromic relay is just about 10 days away from the date predicted 1,000 years ago in this text on the Kalki Avatar. So make of that what you will. Finally, I'll wrap up this session with a message from Maggie Lee of Santa Fe and Santa Monica. The title is Water Births. She's talking a lot about the plant realm in which she has been deeply immersed for many, many years, indeed for a lifetime. And she includes a most gorgeous photograph of milkweed fluff, one of my favorite phenomena of nature, milkweed fluff. Maggie points out that I didn't mention water births in my discussion of traumatic birth trauma. And she points out, of course, that this is an alternative to the traumatic form of birth that is the norm for most people. She also cites Joseph Chilton Pierce, who wrote a book called Magical Child, which for some reason I've never been able to read. But I think it has some interesting information in it about childbirth and the also birth trauma. Finally, I read this last paragraph from Maggie's mail to you. Considering the earthly gems inspiring me to experience organic light, below is one. Others include gardenias and tuberoses, mother of pearl shells, some pearls, pulsating egg yolk jellyfish, moonlight reflected on the ocean or river, surfing inside a wave, bioluminescence, lambs, white lions, and kittens. Wondering as well about the potential to experience the organic light in our biodynamic compost. Upon having a pile arrive on site, my gaze is drawn toward the warm, lambent light softly pulsating from within the pile, rather like bioluminescence to the slow rhythm of jellyfish, as if I can feel how it will feel when it goes inside the earth. At this moment, it becomes more about the light and fragrance than just a pile of brown soil. In your talks with Kundry, reference to fragrance as a component of experiencing the organic light wasn't included, end quote. Well, here is a kind of litany or inventory of some of the natural phenomena which suggest the presence of the organic light. Mother of pearl, white animals, and so forth. Then Maggie goes on to point out that we might be able to detect the organic light even in the most humble of natural phenomena, in the most humble places in the natural world, such as ye old compost pile. And that doesn't surprise me. Here in Belgium, and I'm still here as I record this session, I often have the experience of seeing the organic light rise to the border of natural perception. By natural perception, I mean the ordinary sensorial perception of the natural world. It is true that in order to perceive the organic light in its quality, in its autonomous quality, and in its full splendor, you have to be in an altered state. But who's to say we're not borderline to altered states here and there throughout the day? I find this to be more and more the case. Of course, I live in a privileged locale in that respect. But some of you as well, I think, could relate to that. Drifting in and out of subliminal states in the course of the day. Practicing planetary tantra makes you susceptible to that kind of drift. It gives you more of a flexibility and latitude because it unlocks you from the chiral lock. It unlocks you from the entrainment devices of the archons and allows your attention to float and merge into the Nahual, which is always present. So when I'm walking around here or riding my bicycle, which is a Canadian bicycle, a Granville, through the fields of Belgium, the flatlands of Flanders, I often see what appears to be a near epiphany of the organic light in the colors, textures, and forms of nature itself. It's interesting to contrast this experience with what I feel, see, and sense in Andalusia. In Andalusia, the land is brutal and hard. I have to point this out. The land is very, very hard. It's full of thorns and spines and brambles that will reach out and tear your skin. And the earth itself is very rocky and hard. It's impossible to walk on bare feet where I live in Spain. The rocks are like cut glass. It's painful. And yet at the same time, the presence of the organic light in that part of the world is so strong that it literally eats you all day long. It just comes right out and eats you alive. It's brutal. It's flagrant. And you have to be pretty strong to take it day after day after day. Contrast that to what I experience here in Flanders, where the land is pretty and homely. It's pretty in a homely sort of way. It's not that spectacular, breathtaking beauty of the Serenia de Ronda. And it's farmlands. And it's very often in the color and texture of the earth and of the plants that are sown here that I can see these near epiphanies of the organic light. I mentioned that I had bicycled through a field recently where the linen was growing. The linen stalks were about waist high, and at the top of each stalk was a number of perfect little spherical balls like peas. And yet the color of these linen buds was almost a translucent color. It emanated a kind of supernatural luminosity. The other day I drove through the same field and it had been cut down. So the linen was laying in long swaths across the field, sort of like fanned out in thin swaths where it had been cut down. And there was no longer that luminescent pea green light hanging over the field. But there was a remarkable color in the cut linen. It was something between the pink of fresh salmon and burnished copper. And as it lay along the ground in these long, even swaths, sunlight gleamed on it, but it seemed as if there was another light gleaming out from it. As you know, the signature of the organic light is that it does not shine on anything. It shines out of things. It wells out of material mass. So I would characterize that as a borderline experience. It sounds like Maggie is talking about borderline experiences that she has in relation to many natural appearances, including the compost. As to the fragrance as a component experience of witnessing the organic light, she raises an interesting question. I've talked about the texture of the light I've written about this in Severed Rose. When you have the ability to stand in it over and over again, the sensation of immersion becomes palpable. In the beginning, it only seems like you're standing looking at the light. It's a billowing, imminent presence. But you don't reach it, and it doesn't reach you. It seems like if it did, you'd be a goner. Then you find, with increased practice, that you can actually touch it. It comes and it engulfs you. And this produces deliberate, or I should say specific sensations, including a fine cold sweat and the feeling of cool melon pressed against your skin. So it definitely has the texture, the living organic light, which is the primary substance body of the Aeon Sophia. Does it have a fragrance? Well, I don't know. The Gnostic texts speak of a fragrance. They speak of the fragrance of the originator, actually. The originator being the ground of all the pleromic aeons in all the galaxies. I can't say that I've experienced the fragrance of the originator, nor have I experienced any particular fragrance in my seances with the organic light. But I'm sure it's there. Witnessing of the organic light is a multisensorial experience. It engages all the senses. So it may be a matter of predisposition, or as Don Juan would say, the warrior's predilection. Some witnesses may have the tendency to experience the organic light in the amplification of certain senses, sight, hearing, smell, in a particular combination that's unique to each individual. So this is a most fascinating question and something that I myself would like to explore in my coming telestic seances on the ridge. Finally, to conclude this session on that same note, here's a mail from Miguel on the organic light. This is dated February 26th. He writes, "This afternoon I went up to the hills of my favorite spot, Caredwin's Well. Whilst I was walking, I listened to your second talk with Kundry about observing the organic light. I haven't had any success myself yet, but she was kind enough to show me something to help me. Aha. After listening to you mention some natural phenomena similar to the light, I stooped down next to the lake's edge and observed the attached with a smile. Perhaps not exactly how the light looks, but it interested me to observe how the various bits of vegetation were embedded within the foam. That is what I am finding difficult to visualize with the light, how everything is part of it and not separate." End quote. And I attach here the photo of the foam in the leaves that he included with his email. Pointed out what I consider to be, I won't say a scientific fact, that's archonic language, a verifiable item of terrestrial physics would be a better way to put it. I consider that the organic light has infinite density and zero mass. Now, I don't know what that means mathematically or in terms of any kinds of equations that physicists like to juggle around, like a juggler with plates and balls. But what it means in terms of experience is that you have the sense that the organic light is a foam. It reminds of shaving foam or the kind of foam that is released by those extinguishers, fire extinguishers. Very crude analogies, of course. But it does have a foam-like properties, and it has facets. So this small epiphany at Ceredwen's well is not a small epiphany at all, but is very much, as Miguel notes, her kind way of showing you how to look at what she really is. So on that note, I'll leave you with that beautiful vision and pick up the next email session in a day or so. Safe passage to all.